I'm Charlie Rose.
I'm Nora O'Donnell.
And I'm Gail King. Hey, this is a CBS This Morning podcast.
Dr. Zarif, thank you very much for making time for us.
Good to be with you.
It's been a long road since Vienna when we last spoke. We heard just last night President Trump was very reluctant to certify that Iran is complying with the nuclear deal. Is this at risk of falling apart?
But I think the United States needs to look at this from a different perspective. The United States tried everything that President Trump is thinking about. Over the last 38 years, particularly over the last 10 years. They imposed all the sanctions that were in the books. They imposed all the pressure that were available to the United States. And at the end of the day, they had to recognize the fact, the previous administration, that it wouldn't work, that sanctions did not produce the results that they had expected.
But it got Iran to the bargaining table.
Actually, Iran was at the bargaining table. The deal that we finally were able to make was basically on the same line as a deal that I proposed in 2005 before leaving the negotiations to the next Iranian administration. So the deal was on the table, a deal very similar to the one that was finally made. Unfortunately, the United States at that time, run by people who are now advising President Trump to scrap the deal, like Ambassador Bolton, were reluctant to accept any deal, hoping that they could, through pressure, impose a zero enrichment option on Iran. They tried it, the same policy that they are advocating now. They tried it for 10 years, didn't work, and at the end of the day, they had to come back to the negotiating table and negotiate a deal that recognized Iran's rights. And at the same time, we addressed their concerns. We were always prepared to address their concerns. It was an opportunity when everybody was prepared to make a deal, and we were able to make a deal. I believe it would be a mistake to believe that such a complicated issue could be resolved in any other way other than finding a resolution that was acceptable to everybody and not to simply one side.
So for you, is there any renegotiation of this nuclear deal?
No. I believe it's not a bilateral deal. It has so many important details.
President Trump said it's a bad deal for Americans
and
that there are flaws in it.
It isn't. Well, no deal is completely acceptable to everybody. That's a fact of life. Unless you put a gun on somebody's head and have them sign a surrender deal, then you would not like the terms of any negotiated deal. Negotiations mean give and take. And this one not only involved Iran and the United States, but five other important players in the international community, four of them other permanent members of the Security Council, plus Germany. So there were a lot of interests at stake. A lot of various views came to the table. And this is the outcome of a lengthy negotiation, trying to somehow accommodate all those various interests that were around the table, as well as the interests of the international community. So it would be, I think, misguided and ill-advised to believe that another deal, which would serve the interest of one side even further than this one, could be achieved.
So for you, you think it's a false statement for President Trump to say he can get a better deal. You're saying Iran is not willing to negotiate.
Well, certainly it would be, in my view, much more difficult now to negotiate a new deal than it was 2 years ago, 3 years ago, because now we all know the shortcomings of the current deal. I can certainly tell you that if the impossible happened in Iran, came back to a negotiating position, the demands by Iran would be much different from the demands that we raised when we started the negotiations, because we have seen in practice how the United States has failed to implement its side of the bargain. You see, what is important is now Iran has been verified by the IAEA and certified by the Secretary of State five or six times that it has, including twice by the current Secretary of State, that it has in fact complied with every obligation that it had under the deal. We cannot say the same about the United States. The United States is in breach of important aspects of the deal, including the statement that came out of the White House a few days ago that President Trump, during his visit to Hamburg for the G20 meeting, tried the opportunity to dissuade other leaders from engaging in business with Iran. That is a violation of the letter of paragraphs 26 to 29 of the nuclear deal. So we now know what are the problems, how the United States behaves. So if ever, and I believe it would be unwise and from an Iranian perspective impossible, but if ever there were negotiations again, the demands by all sides would be very different. So that is why Iran and all other participants in the negotiations have said very clearly that this is not a deal that is open to renegotiation, because this is a multilateral deal approved by the Security Council, and it's not a bilateral deal to be withdrawn from or to be renegotiated.
You said the U.S. is violating the letter of the deal. The President of the United States says Iran's defaulting on the spirit of the agreement with ballistic missile tests, provocations of U.S. naval vessels, arrests of Americans. The White House also pointed out continued support for Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad and Hezbollah, all saying these go against that basic agreement between these countries.
No, it doesn't. And we both have grievances about each other's behavior. There are various aspects of the U.S. behavior to which we object. Its support for elements that are bombing innocent people in Yemen, sale of beautiful equipment to Saudi Arabia that is being used to bomb innocent civilians in Yemen, support for people who have promoted the ideology of hatred and extremism that has killed Iranians and Americans and other people across the globe. There are many policies that the United States has followed that are objectionable from an Iranian point of view and from the point of view of many other countries. However, we decided in the nuclear negotiations, because of the degree of differences that the two countries had, to limit the scope of negotiations to the nuclear issue. And that is why Iran has been in compliance with the letter and the spirit of the nuclear deal, whereas the United States has been in defiance of both letter and spirit of the nuclear deal.
Does that mean Iran's going to walk away?
No, because there are procedures that are written into the deal. It's interesting for everybody to understand that this deal was not based on trust. This deal was based on mutual mistrust. We made sure, as did the United States, that there were provisions in the deal for everybody to be able to resort to in case of non-compliance by the other side. So we have been, in the past, resorting to those procedures, even during the Obama administration. And we have a joint commission, that is the procedure for dealing with these issues, coming up in Vienna before the end of this week, an Iranian and American, plus representatives of other participants in the deal, will be there to discuss our grievances, our complaints about U.S. Lack of compliance with certain provisions of the deal, including the one that I just mentioned.
But those things you're complaining about, President Trump in Hamburg getting European businesses to try to stop doing any kind of transactions with Iran, standing in Saudi Arabia and saying that there is a moral requirement for countries to oppose Iran's destabilizing actions in the region. None of that for you is enough to say that this deal is in danger?
Well, obviously, these statements put the deal in jeopardy. But as long as we can find remedies to deal with them, then there are provisions in the deal to deal with them. There are certain red lines, and it's clear when those red lines are met or reached or crossed. And then at that stage, we will make a decision about it.
White House officials were careful to say they're putting new sanctions on Iran to punish Iran for those ballistic missile tests, for the naval provocations. But the White House is not willing to put sanctions on Iran that would blow up this deal. but they are not willing to let Iran continue to misbehave, they say. They're going to take a holistic view of Iran's behavior and the nuclear deal.
Well, we will deal with, we believe, first of all, that those sanctions are misguided and never achieve even the political objectives that they pretend to be following. We believe, as I said, U.S. policy in the region has been the source of a lot of misfortune for the people of our region. As I said, support for countries that have promoted extremism and violence, including on U.S. soil. If you look at the statistics from 2001 onward, 94% of terrorist incidents against the United States and Western countries and the rest of the world have been carried out by Wahhabis, those who receive ideology, support, financial support, assistance from Saudi Arabia. So these are facts on life, on the ground. And for President Trump to try to ignore them for whatever reason, including, as he said, making a deal worth $110 billion worth of beautiful military equipment, all of these, in our view, are misguided U.S. policies. These are resulting in extremism and terrorism and instability in our region. Iran has steadily been a force for stability. Just look at the history. Over the past, since, again, let's start from 2001. Since 2001, U.S. allies, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, have been behind every extremist organization. They were the two countries that recognized the Taliban in Afghanistan. Go check. The only countries that recognized the Taliban as the legitimate government of Afghanistan were Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. The only countries that continue to support extremists in Syria, in Iraq, in Libya, and elsewhere are these two countries. Countries who had their nationals, maybe 15 of the 19 9/11 terrorists came from Saudi Arabia, a few came from the United Arab Emirates. These are the countries that are producing terrorists for you, and the United States is going after Iran. I don't know why. Iran has
because of Hezbollah, because of support for Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad, because of threats by Shiite militias in Iraq and Syria. Those are the concerns from U.S. officials.
You see,
right,
Iran has been consistent. We have come to the aid of governments that are fighting extremism, be it in Afghanistan, be it in Iraq or in Syria. Nobody wants to remember that it was Iran which prevented the Kurdish region's capital, Erbil, from falling in the hands of terrorists. People want to pick certain instances in history to their liking. We went to the help of Mr. Barzani in Erbil to prevent the ISIS, the Daesh, from taking over Erbil. We went by the same token, we went to the help of the Iraqi government, we went to the help of the Syrian government. We are a consistent and persistent supporter of governments who fight against terrorism and extremism. We would do exactly the same if Saudi Arabia fell victim to these terrorist organizations. It doesn't matter. It's a consistent policy that Iran has followed based on our need to see a stable region and a stable neighborhood.
I want to talk about some of the words that you and the president have exchanged, though not directly. You both seem to be using Twitter to communicate your worldview right now. You've called President Trump's travel ban truly shameful. His reaction to terror attacks in Iran, you said, was repugnant in his response. You've talked about what you see as a visceral hatred of Iran. Are the U.S. and Iran on a collision course?
Well, U.S. hostility towards Iran is nothing new. The Iranian people and the Iranian government have been subjected to this type of animosity over the past 38 years, and I believe even further since the United States overthrew a democratically elected government in Iran in 1953. I believe the United States has been on the wrong side of history as far as Iran is concerned and as far as much of our region is concerned for the past at least two generations.
But the President of the United States says that Iran is one of the biggest threats to U.S. interests and the Middle East right now.
Well, as I said, just count the number of terrorists who have been attacking U.S. soil and see how many of them come from Iran or are affected by Iranian thinking or Iranian ideology. Most of them, if not all of them, come from the territories of U.S. allies, affected by the ideology that is promoted by U.S. allies, and at times condoned even by the United States itself.
But do you see this kind of language, this kind of rhetoric, it seems the reverse of, in some ways, that the friendship that you had with the previous administration in being able to sit down and talk to each other?
Well, I wouldn't call it friendship.
Is there a chance at diplomacy with the Trump administration?
I wouldn't call it friendship. We considered each other adversaries very clearly. Nobody had any illusions about the views of the other side. We had a project that we wanted to do together. And we proved that even between two adversaries, dialogue would be possible, that you can reach a solution that that both sides not only could live with, but could consider a triumph of diplomacy. And I think it's possible with the new administration, provided that the new administration is prepared to live by the commitments that the United States government, not an administration in the United States, President Obama represented the entire United States, not simply a part of the United States, as President Trump does. As governments, we recognize the government that sits in the White House or in Tehran as governments representing the entire nation. So we believe that President Trump, if he decides to follow the obligations, observe the obligations and commitments of the United States, then we believe the nuclear deal is the foundation and not the ceiling for resolution of issues.
If Secretary Tillerson wanted to speak to you on the phone, something he said he'd be willing to do, would you pick it up? Would you make that call?
Well, he hasn't made a phone call to me. The point is our colleagues are meeting in a couple of days. They'll be discussing issues that they have routinely discussed. And if the need arises for Secretary Tillerson and I to meet on the nuclear issue, which is the issue that we've been discussing with Secretary Kerry, I doubt that there will be any hindrance to that.
So despite all this rhetoric, despite this concern about whether or not this deal would continue to be certified by the administration or not, you haven't felt it necessary to reach out to Secretary Tillerson directly?
No, because we have a procedure that we follow, and that procedure has worked up until now. Unfortunately, not in the best possible way, because the United States continues to be lacking the political will to be in compliance. And I don't think making a telephone conversation would change that political will. I think the United States, it's necessary for the United States to recognize the fact that this is the best deal that was possible. Of course, it doesn't contain all the elements that we wanted. It doesn't contain all the elements that the United States wanted. That's the name of the game. It's a bargain. It's give and take. And as soon as they recognize that, then we can build on it.
You often say that as foreign minister, you don't have control over the courts. I know that. But now there are four Americans detained by Iran. This week, an American scholar sentenced on accusations of espionage. Isn't that a hindrance to any kind of progress? Why not release them?
Well, as you said, and you rightly said, our judiciary is independent, and you've seen examples of it over the past several days in Iran itself to show that the government doesn't have any control over the judiciary. But as foreign minister, I try to do my best in order to prevent cases of this nature to create further tension in international relations. However, I need to remind you that the United States itself has increased its activity against Iranian citizens over the past few weeks. Many Iranians have been detained both in the United States and abroad on the request of the United States for technical violations of sanctions that happened some 10 years ago, including a pregnant woman who was arrested 2-3 weeks ago in Australia for having been a translator in a technical, a deal not involving anything illicit, but something that was covered by sanctions 10 years ago. She has now immigrated to Australia, is having a child with her husband, mm-hmm. and now as a pregnant woman, she was arrested. Same happened in Barcelona, Spain, with somebody who had been alleged to have violated a sanctions restriction some 9 years ago. Another one was detained in Frankfurt. Others are detained inside the United States. So the U.S. is basically arresting or asking for the arrest of Iranian nationals all over the world. I hope that we can actually stop this type of behavior on the part of the United States and help bring an end to this humanitarian situation.
Well, there is one humanitarian situation. One of those Americans who is now behind jail, behind bars, Bakir Namazi, an American citizen. He's in his 80s. He's in failing health. Why not release him as a humanitarian gesture?
He's not behind bars, but he is not free to leave the country. And as I said,
Is he under house arrest now?
The executive, this is what I'm told, the executive branch of the government does not have control over judicial decisions. But we can do our best to be of assistance, and we are trying to do our best to be of assistance.
Do you think that those kind of gestures can perhaps hit the reset button with the Trump administration? Is there incentive in some ways as a gesture of goodwill to help these Americans?
The Iranian people are not very happy with the way the United States government has behaved over the past many years, particularly over the past several months. We have seen statements that have affronted the entire Iranian nation. As you said, the Muslim ban was an insult to a nation that has done nothing other than the Iranian nationals living in the U.S. have been prominent citizens, have helped cure Americans. The physicians have helped cure them. The engineers have helped built our scientists at the Silicon Valley, one of whom passed away a couple of days ago, have been prominent and leading figures in mathematics and engineering and electronics. These are the type of people who have been denied entry into the United States. So what the United States has done against the Iranian people over the past several months have been really repugnant. And if there is a need for signaling that a desire for a change exists, I think it takes two to tango.
You think it's up to President Trump to show some goodwill?
I certainly think it is up to the U.S. government to stop sending all these hostile signals, not to the Iranian government only, but to the entire Iranian nation, both in Iran and abroad.
You mentioned the battlegrounds against ISIS in Syria and in Iraq, and you said at the request of the Iraqi government, Iran has come in various forms to help win that fight, something American troops are also doing. There are now about 5,000 American troops in Iraq. There are Americans on the ground in Syria. That puts Americans and Iranian-backed forces in pretty close contact. Do you see a risk to that?
We're not interested in confrontation. We believe that the objective of everybody, both in Iraq and Syria, would be to defeat terrorism and extremism and to allow the Syrian and Iraqi people to determine their future, their destiny. Iran is prepared to do whatever it can in order to advance that cause.
If the Iraqi government asks that, can you see Iranian forces and American forces coexisting in Iraq, American forces staying behind after ISIS is defeated?
Well, we have our views about that, but we respect the sovereign decision of our neighbors. We have never contested a sovereign decision that our neighbors make. We cooperate with our neighbors based on the respect for their sovereignty. Whatever they want to do with others, be it in Afghanistan, in Iraq, or in Syria, it's their choice, not ours.
So you're open to it if the Iraqi government requests it?
We have been open to recognizing the choices that our neighbors make, and at the same time, we give them our views, but we stick to our line of cooperation with them, which is cooperation against terrorism and extremism.
Can you clarify exactly what Iran thinks of these de-escalation zones in Syria? President Trump has trumpeted this ceasefire in Syria as a big win. Well, Is Iran supportive? We started
de-escalation in Syria in the Astana process between Iran, Russia, and Turkey, and we believe it is the longest standing agreement. I mean, it's been working since last December. It's not full. It's not without its flaws, but it's the only one that has worked. And we always called for ceasefire throughout Syria. Mm-hmm. This has been one of the premises of Iranian policy with regard to Syria, starting in 2013. When I assumed office in August of 2013, I presented a four-point plan for Syria. The first point of that four-point plan was ceasefire. The second was a national unity government. The third was constitutional reform so that we could disperse power rather than mass all the power in one office. And the fourth was elections based on the new constitution. That offer still stands, and that offer basically was the foundation for Security Council Resolution 2254.
Yet Defense Secretary Mattis says the only reason Bashar al-Assad remains in power is because of Iranian forces propping him up.
He could have framed his position in another way. The only reason that Daesh is not sitting in Damascus as the head of a state is the fact that Iran was there to help Syria. The only reason that Daesh is not sitting in Erbil or in Baghdad is because of the fact that Iran was there to help. So you can frame the issue in whatever way you like, but the reality is that Iran has had a consistent policy of helping regional governments fight extremism. I believe the United States is looking at the wrong address. It has to make its allies accountable for helping extremists ruin our region and the world.
Well, one of America's allies is very worried about Iran's role in this ceasefire. Israel does not feel comfortable, their prime minister has said, with the ceasefire as it's brokered now because it allows Iran to keep a presence in Syria and be too close to their borders.
Our presence in Syria is none of anybody's business other than that of the Syrian people. They will determine who will be on their territory and who will not be on their territory. We don't have any ambitions to stay anywhere outside our borders.
Not in Syria.
We are there on the invitation of the Syrian government. We sent our advisors on the invitation of the Syrian government. And I have to repeat, exactly for the same reason that we sent our advisors to Iraqi Kurdistan, on the invitation of the regional government of Iraqi Kurdistan, President Barzani, for the exact same reason that we sent our advisors to Baghdad to help the government of Iraq. So we cannot pick and choose. We have a consistent policy of fighting extremism, and I hope others would have the same consistent policy.
So is Iran going to leave troops, leave any kind of military installations behind in Syria? That is the presumption that Israelis are making here.
Iran will have its policies determined based on the sovereign decision of Iran and the government of Syria and the people of Syria. Mm-hmm. And I do not believe that it is the concern of anybody else to engage in that decision.
And Iran still believes that Bashar al-Assad has legitimacy despite his use of chemical weapons, something that Iran has suffered from themselves.
Well, as we've said time and again, for Iran, chemical weapons is a red line. We have condemned the use of chemical weapons, no matter who uses them and no matter who the victims are. The point is, we need to investigate allegations of the use of chemical weapons. And there are international mechanisms in order to investigate such allegations. Nobody, however powerful, can be the jury, the judge, the executioner, the prosecutor, everything all in one person or one body. We need to rely on available mechanisms within the international community to ascertain responsibility for a heinous crime of the use of chemical weapons, which we condemn without any qualification.
The U.S. Treasury Department just announced 16 entities and individuals from Iran are now being sanctioned for illicit activity and criminal activity. Does this violate the deal, in your view?
In our view, it violates the spirit of the deal. We will look at it and see whether it violates the letter of the deal, and we will act accordingly. In the past, we have also imposed reciprocal sanctions against our will and against our own best wishes, but as a reciprocal measure against U.S. Illegal action, we have imposed sanctions on certain U.S. entities and individuals, and probably this time we will decide to add to our list of designated U.S. corporations. These are corporations that engage in violating the rights of the people of our region, helping governments to suppress their citizens, or helping to the suppression of the Palestinian people. And we will continue to do that as a means of last resort in response to an illegal action by the United States.
We spoke briefly about the travel ban, but I want to ask you, you're an Iranian national here on American soil. Many Iranians can't arrive here in the U.S. right now because of the existing travel ban. Because of Iran's support for terrorism, that's how the U.S. has justified this. What is your objection?
Well, it's a problem with the yardstick the U.S. is using. The yardstick for the United States in ascertaining who is supporting terrorism is whether they're buying weapons from the United States. Just look at the statements that came out in the last few weeks. People who were not buying weapons became supporters of terrorism, and as soon as they agreed to buy weapons, they immediately changed sides. Is that the yardstick that you want to apply, or whether you have a serious yardstick?
You're talking about Qatar there.
No, I'm talking about everybody who was involved in those military sales. Just look at the statements that were made during the campaign about the track records of various countries who bought all these beautiful military equipment from the United States. I'm not addressing one country, I'm addressing all of them. And it's interesting that the United States uses that yardstick. But the American people can just look at the record. Who was behind 9/11? Whose nationals were involved in 9/11? Were there a single Iranian in every act of terrorism that has been committed against Americans on the U.S. soil since 2001? And if the answer is no, if all the Iranians they know around them, in the cities they live, are prominent citizens, law-abiding citizens, then they'll see that this policy that has been adopted by the President of the United States is an affront not only to Iranians, but to sensible human beings.
Thank you, Dr. Zarif, for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. You can watch the full CBS This Morning broadcast Monday through Saturday from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. on your local CBS station.
Or you can stream it live on the CBS All Access app.
For more information, please visit cbsthismorning.com.